Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another installment of the Comics Pals Book Club, where every month we tackle a new book of your choosing. This month, we have the pleasure of reading Far Sector by N.K. Jemisin and Jamal Campbell, published under DC's Young Animal imprint. Rest in peace. Don't think that's still a thing.
It's not.
As we go through, and if you like what you hear, take a look back at our catalog of other books. Last month we covered off on Black Sad, which is particularly fun, also hosted by me. I like that one a lot.
You forgot the one that you weren't on, Strange Adventures.
Yeah, that wasn't last month.
Oh, damn, that's
Marco
right.
goes away on vacation, just forgets a whole month.
Nothing happens when I'm not there, you know?
Yeah.
Otherwise, apparently, I don't keep up to date, but if you want to, you can do so by following us on all socials at the Comics Pals on TikTok, Twitter, Instagram. Tune in live for our weekly discussions on YouTube and Twitch, where we live stream our main show 10:15 a.m. EST every single Saturday, and Thursdays 6 p.m. EST for Pals Pulls, where we review the week's hottest comics. And lastly, if you want to further support the show and help guide some of these conversations, join the Patreon, where every month patrons get to vote on the next selection of book clubs, and where for as little as $3 a month, you get access to our weekly newsletters, an exclusive show palling around, as well as a first look into all of the new content that we're trying to produce. Kale, is that cheaper than anything you have?
That's cheaper than this whole the whole physical copy of this book, Far Sector, which I got for £24.99.
Thank you very much, Kale.
It's cheaper than the US, actually, Kale.
Wait, what is that cheaper than?
Wasn't it $29.99, the physical copy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
Oh, I'm the exchange
with the
rate.
exchange
Okay.
rate
All
it'd
right.
Yeah,
be
yeah, yeah.
I'm
Yeah.
not global and I'm dumb, so
Worldly.
not me.
I've done gone global.
Oh.
Remember that podcast I did?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, like a few episodes. I was on that one. Ooh, let's not talk about that. With the plugs for our show out of the way, to jump right in, the first thing that I want to talk about is actually N.K. Jemisin, because as I was doing some digging into the book and then also her as a writer, I didn't realize that she's actually, and for listeners who aren't familiar as well, she's actually a novelist. So this is her first foray into comics. She was a back-to-back-to-back Hugo Award winner for one of her series. And on Pals Pulls, we've talked about writers who come in from the book world who come to write comics. And most recently, I'm thinking of Walter Mosley, who did the latest Thing book back in 2022. So I'm curious as to how you guys felt. She, like, did she get, did she understand the assignment? How does it feel like she did writing this series?
Well, she created a new character. She created a what I'm assuming is a new world. She created an entirely new cast of supporting characters. So she basically got to completely avoid the DC sandbox by building her own sandbox within the DC sandbox.
She used an established superhero identity, made a new character within that, made a new god character within that,
Right.
and only managed to reference two other characters.
Yeah. So I think, as a comics debut, first of all, I think the book's great. So as a comics debut, from a writing standpoint, she does a great job. It feels novel-y, but I don't think that that's always a bad thing. And again, she has very little responsibility to understand DC lore, to understand DC's characters. So all that's not even in play. But I think as a debut, this is a very strong entry.
Yeah, I feel like it was wordy, but every word supported the comicness of it, the graphic nature of it. Like the images, did their part. Mm. You know, every bit felt very meticulously put together.
I think what helps too is the format of this. 12 issues. And it was pretty much set to be 12 issues. Young Animal had a definitive structure to it. They were minis or maxis or whatever. And I think having a novelist go into a comic that is not ongoing, it's a set beginning, middle, end, helps them. And I think it really works here in that. And like, yeah, yeah, Sean, you said it feels novel-y, but I think that's a good thing because it's a graphic novel. And it really is taking that kind of novel structure and making it a very visual thing. She has sci-fi chops. I just looked up her her bibliography. And New York Times called her the most celebrated science fiction and fantasy writer of her generation. It's good sci-fi. I found this to be very fun sci-fi too.
The byline right above her name on the book from the Hugo Award-winning author of the Broken Earth trilogy didn't do anything for you.
Broken down.
I think I appreciated the, because it did have a difference in the way that I think it was paced out. And I felt like I appreciated the rhythm there because it did feel a bit different. One of the things that stuck out to me was some of the like romance flair that gets thrown in. And that to me is fun and something that I didn't realize until like I was sort of like confronted with it in the book, that I tend to ascribe more so towards just novels in general as opposed to, you know, superhero comics, however far away this might be from something like that. But I think I appreciated that tone. And one of the things you guys brought up was Sean, you brought up, she created a new character. And I think that that's typically hard to do and then maintain relevance. Because technically, our main character here, Sojourner Mullion, otherwise known as Joe, is now technically like full-on established canon DC. And I think that's a testament to the job well done that she has here.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I think she did do a very good job of creating a character that feels fully realized. And I think to do that without her having to encounter any established DC characters at all, not even to give her the rub. Like there was no desire at all to engage her with that stuff. I think that was very deliberate. And I think it was very smart. She's not, unfortunately, going to continue telling the stories of Joe, which is kind of sad. This is a one and done story. But yeah, the character lives on.
Do you guys think that hurts? That would hurt the legacy of this character because it wouldn't continue on under her, like, penship?
No, I think that this being such a strong start has already made her has already made Joe the character well established enough. You know, that she can successfully carry her own, 12 issue maxi series or whatever, and hold her own in other titles. I think, you know, I think Jemison did exactly what she needed to.
Yeah, having finally read this, I feel like this is even a stronger character start than Jessica Cruz. Is that her name?
I think so. Yeah.
Powering into Green Lantern. Because since her inception, she's kind of just been, you know, batted back and forth between people without any, like, without a real definitive story outside of what Geoff Johns wrote. So, yeah, I thought this was great. And I liked the character a lot. I understand, like, having not read this before, everyone's like, oh, I wonder where Joe's going to be. You know, like, where's that character going to be? And I'm like, I didn't think anyone read that. You know, like, I kind of had not even a bad opinion. I just had like a hard no opinion on the character. And having read this, I'm like, oh yeah, no, I get the fan base around it. I get the fervor, yeah. Wanting her to be around more. Yeah, I'm into it. Yeah.
And not only that, it actually, the book won the Hugo Award for best graphic story comic. So, you know, again, just like more credit onto her name for that. getting into the actual details of the book, Joe, as a newly, I guess, enlisted Lantern, is sent to this planet, or this remnant of a planet, the City Enduring, to help solve a prospective murder, where we open on where it has happened, and we are now seeing a body. And I think that this does a really good job to just frame the story, because a lot of what gets end up getting discussed in this are a lot of political allegories and analogies. And so for us to start on the ground and then in a few pages in make it up to the top, we get to see where our struggles are, and we get to see where the I guess dichotomies are going to play out, one on the ground amongst the people, and then two in the I guess upper echelon of this council that manages the planet. I think politics are probably going to be some of the bulk of the conversation in this. And so just out of the gate, I think the way that she incorporates things like class struggle, like poverty, drugs, black markets, police sentiment, like all of that to be established in this comic, I think is incredibly well done. And it doesn't appear that way from the start, to which I was immediately sucked in, again, to Jemison's credit.
Well, she's a novelist. So, you know, her job, novel over novel, is to establish generally complicated, you know, political, social concepts that can be wrapped up within one book, you know. So it's really not a surprise to me that she was able to do that so fast. You know, it feels like a world that we're stepping into that has a history, and, you know, a deep, complicated history at that. And I thought that was all brilliantly done and executed from the word go. It's also easy enough to understand. I think sometimes with sci-fi stories, these things can get so unruly and out of control. Whether or not the idea behind this this social structure works for an individual reader, I think it's an effective enough vehicle at telling the story that Jemison's trying to tell.
I had a lot of trouble with this, grabbing onto the sci-fi jargon. You know, the City Eternal already feels like, you know, something that I'm gonna have to wrestle with.
I felt like some prophet, you know, shit that I was just like, immediately, I'm like, yes, give me names, give me just words.
Well, yeah, then the names are, you know, Kale of the Green Shirt, who put another sweater on to do a podcast today. Like, that's a name. That's an example of somebody's name. And it's just like, what? And I had a lot of trouble keeping track of who was what and doing what. It didn't, I wouldn't say it necessarily detracted from the story, you know, the capital S story. But I, in terms of like plot, I really had to work to keep up with it.
I really like the world building in this personally. I mean, it's quite literally building a world. But the whole keeping it with the three alien races, and kind of describing each of them and interactions on this world. And like, there's ones that started there. There's the plant people. There's like the digital people. And eventually we kind of see those people specifically in their own issues going forward. But yeah, I like that because it was sort of simple, you know, keeping it to three, but also like, it's not something we really ever get with Green Lantern. Green Lantern, we go to a planet and we see plenty of aliens, but like, we don't really get the juice of their, you know, lore and what goes on in the world. It's like, all right, something bad's happening there. We go there. Oh no, the planet got destroyed. Like, it's very surface level, where this one, I felt like we actually got to be in this city and in the nitty gritty with the politics of it, who these races are and all that. And I was like, even as like a Green Lantern book, I was like, oh, that's refreshing.
Yeah, I feel like I often get lost in stuff like that, but I'm pretty sure I could tell you exactly what the social political situation is in this book. And a lot of times I'm like, I'm barely holding on. I think Jemisin has the knack that a novelist would have to have of being able to establish that and then keep reestablishing it. She's really good at saying the same things over and over again, but framing them just so differently that it doesn't feel like your head's being cracked in, and it's also helping you understand stuff. And then the other thing is that Joe is a human. So to her, a lot of this is garbage. Like it doesn't even make any sense. It's mumbo jumbo that she makes fun of herself, which makes it almost gives us a pass. Like if you don't understand the names, if you don't understand any of that, don't worry, because our main character doesn't either. It's irrelevant.
I think that was such an effective tool to be able to be like I'm literally attached to the hip with you because I'm along for this ride in the same way that you're along for this ride, and I don't feel like I get like minus points for not understanding a thing.
Yeah, there were several moments where even that joke explained the concept that I was wrestling with. You know, they would have a joke and they would go, oh, like in your Earth culture, it would be that. And I go, oh, okay, right. I'm on board.
Yeah.
Kale, happy to be roasted. The races here, just for context, are the Na, who are led up by Marth of the Sea by the Wavering Dark until the sun falls. I read that and I said, fuck yeah.
It sounds like a Warcraft character that got like unlocked a couple titles.
The AT-AT, who are a race of digital AI that has gone sentient based off of their early version of the internet, potentially one of me, led up by the Blaze of Glory, and then the Ketopli, which is the aforementioned sort of plant people, led by Avrip Thorn of the Dry Season. I think the way that the book plays these scenarios, it tells a story even insofar as the names, right? Because you lean back and some of them are based on, oh, this ship, when they had first ultimately destroyed their planet while fighting the Cloud Critocracy, which was this other external force that came in to sort of try to take over these trio of races. The way to enrich the world through that, I think, was such an effective tool, in the same way where one of the big other pieces in this story, in this world, is that they have emotional blockers. And the way that Jemisin explores that is when she notes that all of these people still use words that are expressive, that still show some kind of emotion attached to them. Like, oh, I'm feeling this, when really they could have just said, I think this, or it makes the most sense to do a thing. And it's very subtle. And I appreciated that because it just continues to add layers and layers to this world.
That was one of my only problems with the book, was the emotion blocker thing. I like the concept a lot, but I feel like Jemisin was playing with it to where it felt a lot of times like it didn't actually matter, because people were acting out of emotion. And we saw it constantly. So I really didn't like the fact. And then there were other times where characters were acting so dispassionately that it's like, okay, that's how it should be. But by and large, people weren't acting without emotion. So I struggled with that a lot.
I thought it was, the way I was reading it was that the characters that we see that act with emotion are the rich people, because they don't care about take that drug. So the emotion blocker for me was more of a classist divide, really, as rather than an actual plot device, because our main character is full of emotions.
Nah, she says herself that there are people who are speaking, and she's like, that's them without emotion.
Right.
So it's like, how can you say this character doesn't have emotion when you're literally commenting on their emotional reaction. It just didn't work for me.
Like there was still an expressiveness to them, regardless of the fact that they're supposed to not be. So there's like even at the in the first issue where the peace captain seizes of the cliffs by the Shrieking Ice. I wrote all these names down because I love it. She has a very quick reaction, terse reaction to Blaze of Glory, almost calling them meat salads. And that's where that comment comes in of, oh, and this is them without emotion, where when you see one of the other police captains, Teiji, who decides, I'm going to just wipe out all of these protesters, there is no, like, that is cold, that is calculated. And there's such a disparity in between people who are supposedly all on the same page that I agreed to Sean's point. It took me out of the book because that felt like a logic or world inconsistency.
I wonder if it would have been better to write it as a dampener rather than something that turns it off completely. You know, I think it leads to good beats, like when the wife says, "I can't even mourn my husband." You know, I thought that was a good beat. You know,
Yeah. I think the problem was it sort of felt like she picked and choosed.
Sure.
You know, when to put it in. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple other things that I felt like Jemison did with that too that didn't really work for me.
Do you have an example?
Sure. The whole ring situation. So her ring is supposed to be different from the other Green Lanterns in that it doesn't have as strong a charge. Because it doesn't operate off the central battery or whatever. So she has to actually take time to charge it. And that's supposed to be a big deal, but it never really comes up. Like, they mention how often she has a low charge, but she's always able to do exactly what she needs to do.
Didn't it come to play towards the end when, after she gets into the digital world and she gets out of it, she runs out of battery doing that?
She still gets out of it.
Yeah.
Like, I never.
Because
I
of never that, she has to go into, like, undercover now. She's not a Green Lantern anymore. She gets, like, that undercover gear and then she winds up getting arrested.
She did all that anyway. Like, it never felt to me like, you know, any of that mattered. It was just something to make her different, which I appreciate. It was just something that was kind of glossed over, I felt like.
There was a point, I don't remember what issue it was, but I feel like it was about halfway through, maybe even less than that, where there's a couple of characters who I can't remember talking about her charge and what would happen when she had no more. So every time after that they referenced her charge, I'm like, oh, shit, what's going to happen to her when it runs out? They're going to get her. They're going to get her. They're going to get her.
Yep.
And then that never pays off. And by the end, when she's in this final confrontation, I'm like, oh, my God, she gets on that ship and her charge is supposed to be like, I felt like my iPhone, like when I'm outside, like my shit dies. What's going to happen to me? But then she just. It's fine. Like, there's literally no threat to her life at all as a result of her lack of charge. And that just didn't make any sense to me.
She packed her power bank.
But it was supposed to add stakes to the things that she was doing because there's that risk of, oh, she's not going to come back after doing the right thing. And it never got to that point because there was even a moment where that moment Sean happens in issue 4 with during the protests where the two protesters are coming, you got the two police guys talking, but there's a moment where right after she comes out of the world where she's on like 18% battery and it's supposed to last her 6 minutes, but then it's gonna take 5 days or something to charge, and then only a few, like two issues later, she's at 25% and she can go and do a thing. And that felt also inconsistent because it felt like, again, Jemison was sort of scaling it as needed to add some sort of to add some sort of lofty stake. Like, there's a risk here when really there isn't.
And I thought it was unnecessary because to me, the question wasn't really whether, like, I guess that was established so early that her ability to overcome this situation and survive it was in my mind because they referenced it. But from the jump of the story, it's not really about her ability to survive this. It's about her ability to solve this problem. Yeah. So I don't think that the book even needed to try to establish a risk that's related to her lantern ring, because A, that's artificial and clearly arbitrary. But B, I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in, can she do this? Can she survive this? Or not, mm-hmm. can she survive this? Can she solve this? And that was the intrigue.
And even the regular lantern books don't deal with that anymore. Like, yeah. you know, that concept, you know, of having to recharge the battery is so, you know, it's great for an issue one, you know, get your lantern to say the oath or whatever and show the battery. That's it, really.
Like, it's not heat.
If you're going to introduce it, pay it off. That's like a, you know.
It's Chekhov's gun.
It's just the gun never showed up again in this. So.
Yeah. Yeah, the gun's just on the boy, a shiny gun on the wall. That's a lot of ammo right next to it. I'd sure hate if somebody picked it up and did something with it.
Keeping on Joe, how does she fit the mold of a lantern for you? Like, is she worthy of this?
Oh, hell yeah.
Is Guy Gardner worthy?
Yeah.
Well,
Gnort.
She's more worthy than Hal Jordan. Are you kidding me? Like,
is this our first actual Green Lantern space cop that was an actual cop? Was Guy a cop? Something tells me. No.
He was, jeez.
Maybe he just looks like a cop. That's why I'm thinking.
I think he was a football player, I think.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
Well, not going to search it.
Because John, Joe, and Hal were all in various military. Kyle's an artist. Great radio, guys.
I love the fact that, yeah, I agree, Kyle. I love the fact that they made her all those things, a cop and someone who was in the military. Because, you know, we haven't mentioned it yet, but Joe is black. Joe is a black woman. And that is, I think, critical to, you know, her worldview. It's critical to where she comes from. But also critical is the almost hypocrisy at play of her criticism of some of the ways in which this culture operates juxtaposed with the things that she's been a part of in her life, especially with her upbringing. You know, you're a black woman from Brooklyn, and then you go on to become a cop. Okay. Then.
And I was like, okay, wait. Eric Garner would have had to have happened before she was a cop, right? Like, surely. Anyway.
But then you're also in the military. You know, you're also from. So I thought that was interesting. I liked it a lot that, you know, Jemison could have played it super safe and said, oh, she's a sociologist. You know, she's a really smart college. Like, I'm sure all that's true, too. Like, she's real smart. But like, she went a direction that's cross to the way this character seems like she would be. And I thought that was really, really smart.
I like how quickly they establish her backstory too. It's just like a series of pages. Like it's very specific. She was in 9/11 essentially as a kid on the fallout of it. Forced her to, you know, it drove her to, you know, join the military instead of going to Princeton, which she got her, you know, an acceptance letter to, which then drove her into the police academy. Then during the Black Lives Matter movement, it's a very specific timeline that I think is really good, honestly. And more common than you'd expect.
Well, and I really think Jemison does a great job playing with it too. You know, using her guilt and the hypocrisy of it all to fuel the way she's thinking about this society and this, you know, these crimes. a lot of the book is her wrestling with herself and the way she feels, and trying to figure out how to do it right, as though this is her second chance.
Yeah, absolutely. And the scene where we see like the cop, her partner, you know, hitting someone, a black man with a gun, and she's kind of standing there watching it. They show that panel twice, and the first time I didn't connect that that was her, and I don't know if that's just I wasn't paying enough attention, but I didn't. The second time they show it is in that montage of her life history, and I was like, oh shit, that's crazy. And it reminded me, like, I know a real person who had that exact same experience, where he actually witnessed the death of a kid, the shooting of a kid, at the hands of his partner. And he didn't rat his partner out. Like, he didn't tell the police the context of what he had witnessed, but he left a force over it. And he never, like, he told me these things many years ago. He never, like, got over the fact that he didn't stop it. That, like, he didn't have the strength of will to stop that in the moment. And I always thought, like, that story, he told me that so long ago, that always stuck with me. So when I saw that here, I was like, wow, holy shit. And tack on the fact that she's a black woman who just watched the abuse of a black man. And she's a cop. She's on the side of quote unquote good. And she's witnessing this horror and not stopping it.
And she ends up dealing with the ramifications of that, right? Like, she ends up being the one punished. And I think that then plays into when she's in, like, in the middle of the crowd and she sees like the abuse happening, and she's wrestling with and trying to understand why that approach would be taken when and she expounds on all of this idea on like her version of justice and what that looks like, not only in that scene but then towards the end of the book as well, when they're wrapping everything up. It's like, you know, turning onto your own people and the people that you're supposed to protect is inherently wrong, emotional or not. It's logical to want the best for a people, regardless of whether or not you agree or disagree with them. And following orders is not enough of an excuse. Never is it enough of an excuse.
I don't know. I felt like I actually interpreted it another way, I guess. I felt like the fact that the people allegedly didn't have emotion made it so that the choice they were making to execute these people was a dispassionate, purely logical decision of, hey, these people are a problem and this is getting out of hand, and we can keep the peace better by getting rid of them and not dealing with this. And it was her emotion and her passionate reaction to what she perceived as injustice to say, wait, this is not okay. We can't do this. And her emotion allowed her to intervene in a way that solved or saved people from having to deal with that.
As like being that introduction of like a sympathy for a fellow person.
And an empathy. Yeah. She wasn't going to stand in the way or stand, you know, aside and allow this kind of thing to happen again.
I also think that this, you know, this sort of goes back to what we were saying about sort of the way she wrote some of these emotionless characters. It didn't even necessarily click for me that police captain was emotionless or whatever. I thought he was just kind of your generic police character who's written flatly because you're never going to see him again.
Right. That's funny.
So it didn't even click.
I think that situation could have been presented better to establish that very fact that, like, hey, this is a clear-cut situation to us. There's no reason for us not to do this. And Joe's emotion and passionate response to this prevents them from doing that. That's how I read it, but I don't think that they did such a great, or she did such a great job of making that clear, if that yeah. was the case.
One of the other things that gets introduced here is Joe's sexuality. And she has a relationship with a previous relationship with the peace captain, and then throughout, you know, in a portion of this book, with Marth, the leader of the Na. And I appreciated how that gets expressed here as well. It's subtle. It's not necessarily like offhand, but it's done in a really simple way where she's just allowed to exist without it having to be a larger part of her character. And whereas it's more pertinent her history with the police, or with her history within the military, that drives and adds to the story, whereas this is an aspect of her to just develop her character more.
I was so glad there was no like backstory of her sexual history or sexuality. Like let it be what it is, you know. It doesn't matter, it doesn't serve the story. It's a fact about her that's fine and cool, and I have no problem with it. We don't need it helps more not to address it, to just let it be.
Yeah. When you live in a world full of different aliens, there's no point in letting a gender binary bother you.
That's what I was gonna say. Yeah, yeah.
They're
aliens, so.
But even when she's on Earth, you know, she makes that offhand note to the Guardian when the Guardian's in, you know, the disguise, you know, like, oh, yeah, I don't have the consent for this. So they kind of seed it throughout that, you know. But also like sci-fi and like being straight in sci-fi makes no sense.
Being what you are is what it is.
Exactly. Right.
As some of the other things that get discussed here, poverty within the AT-AT, for example, and they're struggling with memes. I thought that was an interesting way to look at the lack of emotion, where creativity is drawn from that emotion. And I thought that was an interesting concept to then turn into and commoditize, where I feel like we do that now in our own world, where, you know, memes are valuable. People who create those things and have far reach are commoditized, to make it where it is almost like sustenance for them is a step further and beyond that.
Yeah, go ahead, Tyler.
I also like because they're birthed from the internet, it makes sense that this is essentially their lifeblood. It's an extension, because memes are a way of representing emotion and creativity. I think there's a study that like GIFs and memes are more emotive than words in, you know, getting emotions across. There was like a study about that. So like this being the natural trajectory of that, once, you know, an actual civilization is born from the internet, it makes sense. And also they made a Warcraft reference to Leroy Jenkins. So I was all about that. I'm like, yeah, that's some good meme right there. That was a tasty meme for me. I get it.
It helped me when I thought about this from the like NFT crypto standpoint of like, oh, they're buying NFTs, and this is all like a cryptocurrency scam that this entire culture is run off of.
Man.
It did feel like our real life in a lot of ways. If you think about the idea that, you know, people use memes and the things that are creatively made with, you know, human creativity and ingenuity, we consume those things as means of escape from our problems in life. And these people are using these emotional blockers essentially to do the same thing. They can't control themselves. It's a major problem. Instead of confronting why that lack of control is the thing, and how they can be better as people, they just say, let's shut this down. And I think, you know, when you look at our real life, we're avoiding that. We're avoiding these deeper issues and conversations constantly. And we're replacing that with memes.
Easy, consumable, short for our ever shrinking attention spans. Did these things, like the class struggles, the conversations on the drugs in general for switch off, and like, did this help make the world feel a bit realer for you? Or was that still, because of the context that it was in, did it still separate that and make it feel like sci-fi?
Felt real to me, in the sense that I was in on it, you know, like I thought that, you know, everything about this world felt realized, and it felt like it had history that was there before we got there, before Joe got there. I had no issues with any of that.
Lived in.
I got to say, to kind of piggyback off that lived in feeling, the architecture work by Jamal Campbell is insane in this. Just the way he designs this world. There's some in the trade. There's some back matter. You could see like some of his processing for the original designs for this. It's gorgeous, honestly. It's alien, but still like, all right, I get it, which is like perfect science fiction.
Unrelated to the art, I was really frustrated because they have the trade for this on DC Unlimited. Oh, you had the same experience, but you have to have Ultra.
No, I didn't. Order.
Oh, so why did you not? Well, beside the point.
Because I saw it. I know what you're talking about.
They have the Ultra. You're only able to access it if you have Ultra. You have to pay, instead of the $80 that I have for the subscription for the year, you have to have the upgraded version to get access to the trade that has additional back matter and all this stuff, versus just having access to it. I can only read this in individual issue format. And I was pissed.
What's the equivalent in physical? Like
it would be like walking into the bookstore and then handing you the 12 issues and being like, oh, you can't buy the trade because you have to pay $100 for it. Sorry.
Genuinely, that might be the single dumbest thing I have ever heard as it relates to digital comics. I can't believe what you just told me.
It was stupid, dude.
I can totally believe it. There's a plus for everything now.
Yeah. And like even some simple stuff like Watchmen.
And it's bringing Watchmen's down the internet. On there?
I don't think so. Not anymore.
Of course people pirate comics. What the hell else are you going to do? DC won't let you read the damn trade digitally. You have to read the single issues digitally. What?
Yep.
And this app ain't that great.
And according to our Discord, they charge you multiple times by accident, too. Uh-huh.
So. That's right.
By accident.
Yeah.
Quote, unquote.
But back on the art, I'm not as familiar with Jamal's other stuff. And for me, I think the style also worked really well. Just clean lines, clean inks. And what really sold me on this was how bustling everything felt. The panels are full to the brim. The worlds that are showcased here are expansive, and there's so much in there to want to look like you can explore. And I thought that was a really cool way to visually represent how futuristic, and also just how many people live here. Because they make reference to, you know, 20 billion people, 18 billion people, all this. But then to represent that within panels, I thought it was brilliant work to make you feel like you're cramped.
This book is stunning. Jamal Campbell art is so, so good. His design for Joe feels iconic to me. Like, I can see her on those Alex Ross paintings. I can see her there. Like, when you first open the book, you know, and it's raining, so she has her like raincoat on and stuff like that, and those big ass cool glasses that she wears that are not real because she's a Green Lantern. Like, that's just sick as hell.
That's my one complaint with her costume. I really hate that visor.
Oh, what? I love it. You didn't it's like so that? Good.
No, I really don't.
That's some Morpheus ass shit, man. Yeah. They're not even on her face for real.
Yo, Sean, you love the Matrix references in this book, didn't you?
Dude, the Matrix is my favorite thing. I know. Yes. Issue 2 where she's Morpheus, bro. Yeah. Oh my god!
With and the later green on, nails? her and Ikenhez are Neo and Trinity. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Oh, so good.
I love the design of this costume.
Yeah, the visor, I love everything.
It feels functional. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it feels like I can put this on rather than, you know, like Hal's just like, oh, it just comes on him. You know, a poor turn of phrase, but like it just appears on him. It's a better way of saying it, but yeah.
I thought the intros where she would randomly pull from, or they would randomly pull from different medium was really, really interesting.
The recaps.
You'd have like more romance story stuff, fantasy stuff. The Matrix
Alien was referenced here with the mech. Yeah,
those allusions I thought worked really, really well and were homages to just other sci-fi books that I drew me further in. I'm like, oh, you guys are pulling from good shit.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was gonna say, and also like DC does not have recap pages, so like this is different for DC to do this as well. And rather than it just being the traditional Marvel recap page, which is just text, this kind of just recaps you into the feeling of it rather than the actual story of what's going on. I thought they were really fun, honestly.
And it's something you can't do in novels. So I love the fact that, you know, Jemisin found ways to take the comic book format and do meaningfully different things with it that she couldn't do if this was just a novel. That wouldn't come across. Oh, this is the Matrix, right? Like you wouldn't be able to visually tell that. So I thought that was really smart. And just in general, Jamal Campbell for me, with this 12 issue series, you know, I don't remember what else was coming out in 2019 or whatever, but damn, if this isn't one of the better looking books of that year, like it has to be. This is just so damn good.
Yeah. Did coloring too.
Yeah.
And the coloring, I wanted to bring up the coloring because coloring is insane. So, the thing that jumps out to me, and it could just be because it's color, but when you think of a Green Lantern book, you can't help but think of the spectrum and how different colors mean different emotions on the emotional spectrum. In this, throughout it, there are moments when, like, Joe gets angry and it's colored with red lighting. There's that one scene where she sees, like, the people in that, like, body farm or whatever, and it's all red and yellow. So it's, like, rage and fear, you know? It's a great way to kind of bring in that idea of the emotional spectrum of color without bringing in that, you know, the friggin' Power Rangers of the DC universe. And then looking in the back matter, I think there was a page where he even drew Joe in different lighting for all the spectrum colors too. So I was like, all right, maybe I wasn't crazy. I think this was purposeful. I thought it was great. Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to mention, sorry, was that Joe looks black. And a lot of times, and it helps that, you know, writer, artist, both black, but a lot of times black characters in comic books don't actually look black. Look at Storm over the last, I don't know, however long, especially the House of Powers era.
Even look at some of these variant covers in the back of the trade.
Yeah, like, and all the characters that there's a lot of blackness in this book, despite them being aliens. And, you know, it's what I like to call incidental blackness, where it doesn't matter that they're black. They just are. And to me, that's the most effective form of quote unquote diversity, where the characters just are what they are. And I really, really appreciated that we got that here. And a lot of it, and it wasn't a factor of the story.
What was your guys' favorite, I guess, part of this world? What was it that stuck out to you or stuck with you that persisted?
From the world?
Are you asking for like my favorite part of the book?
Sure.
honestly, I like when they go into that whole AT-AT world. You know, that's them getting into the Matrix. And then they quite literally make that homage. I thought that was a really fun thing. And her trying to kind of ground herself in another new world within her world was like a good display of Joe's willpower through it all. I don't think willpower is even brought up as a term in this book at all, which is a Green Lantern book. But it is showed without explicitly saying it. I thought that whole issue was probably one of my favorite ones. Gorgeous, too.
I also really liked how, you know, she's now been on at least two physical worlds, right? When you say that word, right, it's so, especially for us, you know, obviously we're humans, the writers of this book, human. When you say the word world, you think about Earth because that's where we're at. But like, what is a world? You know, she's able to orient herself in this digital space because she interprets it as just another world. A world is where people live. And the digital world is a world just like Earth. It's just not physical. And I like how she was able to make that tweak in her brain, which allowed her to accept the whole thing. That was pretty smart.
It goes in her head from like capital W to lowercase w, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's real smart.
Kale?
You could say it's the mech. It's fine.
I don't think I have a favorite part. Like, I just like the whole thing.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I like the concept of her ring, I think, the most, despite what I said of sort of the, you know, the mis-execution, because I think that sets her apart, and I think that's really, really, really interesting. But overall, I think it's just like her and the book. You know, this is a noir story that if you take parts out of it, it doesn't work.
Do we know she's showing up soon in the next Green Lantern book coming out, right? As we record this.
Well, she was in Infinite Frontier and all that stuff, so she's still like going to be like in the Dawn of DC stuff.
Yeah,
Jeremy Green Lantern.
Jeremy Adams Green Lantern.
Yeah, I feel like that's the case.
Okay, that's good. I like that she's getting some staying power too.
Well, or deserved. I'm sorry, is Jeremy Adams writing the HAL focused one?
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's writing the HAL focused one. But I think your point stands that she is featuring in the other Green Lantern book that, you know, has more characters.
And like, think about the other, you know, young animal books that were there. You know, like, yeah, Doom Patrol, but like, there were already pre-existing, but like Mother Panic, Shade the Changing Girl, like none of those really had the staying power that Joe's been having. So good to see.
They need to do more with her. 2019 was too long ago.
Sure. And I think it helps that she's attached to something bigger.
Right.
You know, whereas like Shade, not so much, and Mother Panic, I don't know what that is. You know, you have Doom Patrol, like you said, that's established. You can slot Joe in because the book was good and popular, and she's attached, so it's not like, you know, it's not a hard sell.
Yeah.
As we wrap, would you guys, are there any other call outs you guys want to chat through? Otherwise, would you recommend this book? And to who?
Of all the books we've done on the book club, I think this is one of the most accessible. And obviously, I mean, that's going to be one of the strengths of an N.K. Jemisin. You want a book that's going to be telling a story in 12 issues that feels complete and accessible, you get someone like Jemisin, because she's a novelist of tremendous skill and success who knows how to build a YA audience in one book. That's what you have to be able to do. And she's good at it. And we see that novelists who are just talented writers have been able to make a very successful transition. Like, there's probably a reason why Tom King's books are all 12 issue series, you know what I'm saying? And so she does that tremendously well. I would recommend this book to pretty much anybody, but someone specifically who has a taste for sci-fi stories. I have certain friends in my life who are Black, who like comics, but, you know, without necessarily speaking it, don't feel served by the typical comic book. So I think this would be for them.
Yeah, what's wrong with this? I think this is a good, if they like sci-fi, this is a good recommendation. Yeah. Or even if someone was like, hey, you know, I want to read DC Comics, but I don't know where to go. This is fine. Like, sure, it doesn't really, you know, bring them into the DC universe, but it's a good one and done comic, you know, as a trade.
Yeah.
Good stuff. With that, thank you all for joining us on another book club. As I mentioned earlier, if you want to help guide further conversations with our book clubs, join the Patreon where you get a vote every month. Otherwise, let us know how you liked this book, whether or not you'd recommend it to somebody. If you picked it up off of one of our recommendations, shoot us an email at thecomicspals@gmail.com. Leave us a comment anywhere that you're watching this, YouTube, Twitch, well, not Twitch, if you're tuning in live for sure, Instagram, Twitter, whatever it might be, your form of reaching us, and let us know how you liked it. Thank you again, and until next month.